The Lord be with you.
Also with you.
Well, welcome. This is a real celebration for me. I have been dreaming and scheming about this event for several years, and it's a real joy for me to see it come to fruition the way it has. You're in for a treat for the soul, the spirit, and the palate, because we also have the Lefsel House catering tonight and subsequently every night that we're doing the series. I first encountered the term pietism as a dirty word. Coming from Eastern Canada, where the Lutheran church that I grew up in was a monolith, where there was basically one kind of Lutheran, primarily German, and we didn't acknowledge others. There were other people around, but we didn't really know that. It was a real revelation for me to find out that there were Swedish Lutherans. I was a teenager before I discovered that. I didn't know that the Lutheran Church extended beyond the Germans. And then I knew that there were some Finns up in northern Ontario, so there must be Finnish Lutherans, especially since when I got to seminary, one of the professors was Finnish. But I had never encountered the experience of pietism. It was a foreign territory for me, and it wasn't until the merger of our churches that I first realized that there was such a thing as Lutheran pietists. And quite frankly, those of us in the East, a number of us, were quite shocked and almost, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but we almost backed out of the merger at the convention when we discovered there was not going to be a wine bar. We wondered what we'd gotten into. We learned there was a good reason for that, why that wasn't there, and we learned that there were some positive things. But we also encountered a legalism that deeply disturbed us, that was born to the church as we knew the church. We had encountered it in pockets within different people within our church, but not as a group. And we seemed to be encountering this strict legalism that was very negative. Couldn't figure it out, and it seemed to reflect fundamentalism. And I was told that was pietism. It took me a little while to discover that wasn't true, but that was the reputation that pietists had in the circles that I traveled. It was a misguided, very foolish, very negative thing that should be discouraged. Fortunately, when I came to be editor of Canada Lutheran, I began to meet real people in Western Canada other than former LCA people, and discovered things don't add up here. The stories I'm hearing about what these people are like, these people, whoever they were, are not the people I'm meeting. Yes, I was meeting some negative legalists here and there, but they weren't particularly from any one group. That was just the kind of person they were. And I was discovering that there was a concern for Bible, there was a concern for ethics, and there was a real seriousness about, and I don't mean seriousness in a somber type of seriousness, but I mean a seriousness about the faith among some of the people that were new to me. And I was thinking, this isn't really what I've been told. And the institutions that were formed by the pietists, as I started to travel and go to those places and see what was being done there, and I thought, this isn't what I've been hearing about pietism. There's something different going on here. What is this about? Well, I kept exploring and being open to that, and the real breakthrough for me was Dr. Cam Harder. And I'm very grateful for having Cam in my life, and we started to have some conversations about that. And he talked, as he will tonight, about what it was to be a pietist, aware of those things, aware of those attitudes, experiencing some of is persecution too hard a word? Maybe not. But I mean, he'll tell you his perspective on that and how he had to struggle to reclaim his pietism and just tell people, I am a pietist and it's a good thing to be. There's many positive things, and that's what we want to, this series is about, to help people. If you have, most of you may not have experienced that serious negativism that I did, but it's part of this pietistic movement, is part of the heritage of this community. And before that is, well, some would say it might get lost. I don't think it will. But we want to make sure that the stories are told, that we're well aware of all the good things, because I think it's a foundation to continue to grow from. I think it's something that we need to, not only if we aren't aware of it, rediscover, but I'm hoping that many of you that have grown up in this church, in Camrose and other places where you were influenced by the pietistic movement, that you will use these 5 evenings as also an opportunity for you to share your stories, so that the younger ones here can hear those stories and understand where their roots are, so that that doesn't get lost before your generation passes on. I've seen good evidence that many of the positive things that our pietist forebears in this region laid as foundations are still alive, and they are going to flourish into the future. But we need to tell our story to the next generation. And that's part of what this is all about, reclaiming that. And so we have 3 people who will be lecturing or talking. I'm not sure if lecture is going to be the right word. It's good. Conversation is part of what I think we're aiming for, isn't it? And they all, I think all of you claim pietism as part of who you are, right? And Dr. Bowl will be here as well. They all are proud of what pietism and how it's been part of their lives. They have some wonderful positive things to say, and I think you're going to benefit from them, as I expect to benefit from it. I also discovered in that journey that I too come out of pietist roots, but I didn't know that story. And it was only when I started to work with I'm blanking on names here, David Goa and
Harold
Russ, and we started talking about things, and I started saying, wait a minute, I remember that the older pastors in the East were trained in Germany because we didn't have a seminary, and that there was a mission movement in Germany that saw that seminary functioned. And sure enough, when I did my research, I discovered that it was part of the pietist movement of Europe. And so that the Lutheranism, some of the sweetness I knew about Lutheranism, gosh, turns out that I've been a pietist in some of my leanings all along. We just never knew that word, never used it. So I have appreciated this, to be able to claim that I too have pietist roots, and I'm learning to be proud of them and learning to recover them, and I hope you will too. Now, as good pietists, or maybe just good Christians, I don't think there really is a difference between the two, we entered this CLBI, the Ronning Center and Messiah sponsoring this in faith. We agreed to venture forth with this, but we don't have a budget for it. We're trusting that we're not charging a registration fee or a tuition fee for this, so we're trusting that out of the goodness of your heart, some of you will step forward and make donations to the Ronning Center to help us to pay the bills for presenting these 5 presentations. We have some costs in terms of bringing in speakers and a few other things. So I know that David would be glad to talk with you about that, but I know as a true pietist, he doesn't really like to talk about that kind of stuff. Anyway, do you have a few words to say?
Oh,
I have one question to field for you that came from the Messiah study group yesterday that we did. What on earth does the title of this series mean, and where did you get that?
The genius of pietism. Genius. What is its effective kernel? What's its gift? What's its life-giving gift? And the challenge of modernity. All of us who have lived through parts of the 20th century know how unbelievably demanding this period in history has been. It has had a real habit of engendering amnesia in us. It has had an enormous habit of pitting people against each other. Religious people from with different traditions and different gifts, different streams within the same church, and of seeing those oppositions as absolute. Pietism has been a deep part of this place. And in a sense, we are, this coming year, as some of you may know, is going to be the centennial of Augustana. And it doesn't really begin for a while yet. But we want to do what we can do to invite all of us and the whole of the community to take some time to think about what has made this place what it is. With its gifts, with its challenges, with its wounds, and with its joys. So we invite you to come and to think with us and to engage in conversation with us over the 5 evenings that we've laid out here. I think of a wonderful line of Yaroslav Pelikan's, "Jesus was never less than a moralist and was always more than a moralist. Jesus forgave as no moralist can and made a demand on human beings greater than any moralist would." Reminds me of my father and of many of the people that had all its best in that spirit that lie in the hill not far from here. So we're delighted to welcome you, delighted to have you join in this and spend the evening with us. Dittmar, I've asked Dittmar to introduce Cam for us.
For most of you, Cam needs an introduction. A lot of you know him way better than I do, although he came here about 85 to Camrose, and we had already been here for 5 years, so we were the old timers. And Cam was the new kid on the block. But a lot of you have had him as your pastor, minister, community member, leader for at least about 12 years here, right? And then Cam did his PhD in Toronto and studied with Roger Hutchinson in contextual theology. A lot of you have actually, well, some of you have heard part of his thesis. Cam spoke here at our farming conference, and the issue of shaming that a lot of people face in farm bankruptcy. So dealing with the rural crisis, you should discuss the 4 S's of how rural communities destroy themselves. So shaming, sacrifice, I think, survival of the fittest, and scapegoating were the 4 S's, if I remember correctly. Yeah, roughly? I passed. Good. Okay. But since that time, he's been a professor of systematics at Lutheran Theological Seminary and has traveled widely from India through the United States, Canada, to look at all sorts of groups or institutions that are dealing with rural development, and recently has then, together with a few others, Nettie Weeb, etc., created Circle M, which is the Center for Rural Leadership and Ministry. And so training people in ministry to take the rural seriously. So how do you assert leadership in rural communities, and how do you minister in rural communities and not sort of separate your spirituality from what actually happens in your community. And so he's the executive director of Circle M as well. So Cam is extremely active and busy, and even when he was here, he used this time to make contact with people who are concerned about ministry and leadership in rural communities. So I think it's great for Cam to help us uncover some of the roots of pietism that have shaped Camrose as the community it is. Thank you.
Well, it's really good to be with you, and if there is a particular, a singular genius to pietism, it may be that it's a passionate Christianity. And coming back here yesterday reawakened again for me, or kind of fanned the fires of that passion. It's always wonderful to experience the kind of excited, sometimes upset, sometimes always engaged, and deeply believing forms of the faith that I encounter among you. And so, and well lived out, you know, in the host of things that are happening in this community. I'm always impressed by the number of ways in which you're trying to put your faith into some kind of practical action. That is very Haugian and I think Christian. So I want to tell you a little bit about Hans Nielsen Hauge, give you some of the background that even those of you who are Haugians may not be entirely familiar with. And a little bit about the revolution that occurred in Norway, and perhaps what some implications might be for revolving our own church, maybe turning upside down some of the things that are happening in our own church and our social context. Hauge was born, I think, in a time that was ready for revolution. Europe had gone through some really rough stuff, and Norway, of course, had shared in that the Black Death in some of the middle years, followed by the Little Ice Age in Norway. I'll say a bit more about that in the beginning, but the net effect was a tremendous amount of pressure on Norway's bonder, their peasant farmers. They constituted about 85% of the population of Norway. They were a huge class, but they were really struggling economically. That climate change that I referred to occurred between 1650 and 1750, during which temperatures plummeted and the Norwegian glaciers grew dramatically. And when you've got a country with only about 3% of its land area that's arable, and then you're having to lose that to pastures icing over, crops failing, animals dying, severe flooding and destructive avalanches in the spring, it makes for some pretty desperate farming. I looked at some documents by that Gene Grove and Arthur Battigal had pulled together out of Norway's tax records, which I thought was kind of interesting. For example, the Lowland farm in and I don't speak Norwegian. I'm sorry, that's a serious disability of mine. In Nordfjord, Fogdery lost its outlying fields and its cattle pastures. The report on the rock falls that damaged its fenced-in buildings, the fields that were washed away even close to the homestead, the fact that the river actually changed its course as a result of that flooding and destroyed the fishing that they also relied on. And so this is how the tax record ends, with these words that I think were characteristic of many of them. The farm does not nearly pay its way, and the occupants, one after another, have been impoverished and had to leave the farm, leaving all of the buildings deserted. And I've seen the same thing on many of our prairies, these empty buildings, one after another, across the prairies. And I've talked to many of those same families that have experienced that kind of loss and impoverishment. As the peasants left their farms, the land was quickly grabbed up. They were displaced and poor, but the land quickly landed in the hands of others, foreign investors who bought up foreclosed farms and then charged unfair rents to those that were no longer able to afford land but were trying to rent, often engaging in unscrupulous trade practices. And then the acquisitive practices of the church and the government. They accumulated land so aggressively that although the bonder, as I said, constituted about 85 to 90% of the population, the king, the church, and the aristocracy owned about three-quarters of the land at the time that how he comes on the scene. So a very heavy concentration of ownership. The church collected that real estate in several ways. The church would support a royal enterprise or a new tax with some kind of public support. And then the king would reward the church with land. Or the church would make loans to the peasant farmers and then foreclose on them when their crops failed and they couldn't pay. And of course they put strong spiritual pressure on their members to deed their land to the church in their wills, and so gradually accumulated a lot of land. The government amassed some of these holdings in a variety of ways. One of them was by creating a large number of misdemeanors for which Bonder could be fined. And then the corrupt sheriffs would milk them further by fabricating charges and requiring bribes for ordinary government services, and those who protested or wouldn't pay had their land confiscated. There were, of course, lots of tax arrears. It seems like Norway, Denmark, and Sweden were in constant conflict with each other. And as a result, those wars being expensive, the Bonder had to pay the taxes. And there was a fairly obese hierarchy that lived a life of luxury that they expected the Bonder to support. And so perhaps some of the worst suffering tax-wise came during the time when Hauge was in his early 30s. And Denmark, which at that time was ruling Norway, refused to go to war with Britain against Napoleon, and in reprisal, Britain blockaded the Norwegian ports, preventing any trade from occurring. And I'll talk a bit more about that, but it put a serious crimp on Norway's farmers. They had to import many of the things they needed to import and export. They couldn't get out, so they couldn't get in the grain they needed when the crops failed. They couldn't sell their grain when they had excess. They couldn't get access to salt to preserve the food they needed, and so on. So there was really some abject poverty, really real starvation occurring during the period among the farmers, and during the period that the bond, or during the period that Hauge was exercising his ministry. Several times there were revolts against the rulers. So between the 15th and 18th centuries, there was a number of these protests. And even around the date of Hauge's birth, maybe just a year before, there was a wave of national feeling that swept through Norway, and protests were launched against Denmark's control of the country. When Hauge was about 15, Christian Loftus, who was the Bonder leader, signed grievances with the crown prince, trying to protest these aristocratic privileges and the power of corrupt officials and so on. So it wasn't as if nothing had ever happened that was going to, as if the Bonder had simply accepted their lot passively. But the protests tended to be quickly squelched. The Loftus revolt, for example, lasted less than a year. The government simply sent out military to arrest him and the peasant leaders, and that was that. They had early on instituted a vagrancy law that prevented unauthorized travel of the Bonder outside of their home parishes. And the Conventicle Act, passed in 41, just about 30 years before Hauge was born, prohibited the unauthorized gathering of peasantry. It's kind of interesting because that Conventicle Act, which is what Hauge was eventually jailed under, was initially designed by the court preacher, by Luma and Bishop Peter Hersley, and the churches gave it their full approval. And it was to, in a sense, was intended to help allow for the gathering of Christians outside of the church on a Sunday morning, but only under the direct supervision of a pastor. And so that's where, of course, Hauge got into trouble, as we'll see. In each of these revolts, the government's position was regularly backed up by the church, because the church aristocracy was mostly imported from abroad. They were getting their living paid for by the state, and they were guaranteed a living for their descendants. And so there was a terribly strong incentive for the church leaders to back whatever the government was doing. And there was also a kind of an effect, I guess, on the way that they preached and ministered to the people in their parishes as well, because they tended to emphasize obedience and good citizenship oftentimes rather than the gospel. And so some of the sermon titles that we have on record from that period are rather illuminating. One's titled Love of the Fatherland, and another The Best Christian is the Best Citizen in the World, and a number that were kind of rationalist efforts to debunk biblical miracles. And then such inspirational offerings as On the Wisdom of Placing Cemeteries Outside of the Cities and How to Grow Potatoes. And then this Easter one, which is one of my favorites. Easter's nicely robbed of any revolutionary potential by preaching on the theme, The Value of Early Rising. I'm going to have to work on some of my sermon titles. These ones are grippers. And so the confidence of the bonder in their church and in their spiritual leaders, as they became more corrupt and more clearly allied with a government that they no longer had confidence in either, was growing. They were starving in some ways, economically and spiritually. And one of them, not the only one, but one of them decided to do something about it. Hans, Neil's son, right, the took the name of the father, so Neil's son, his dad was Niels Mikkel's son, was born on the Haugi farm, so that's where he took his surname from, the Haugi farm, in Tuna Parish, about 50 miles southeast of Oslo in 1771. He grew up in a modest home, 8 brothers and sisters, equally divided, 4 brothers and 4 sisters, I guess 5 boys, in a fairly warm hearted home. I think his descriptions of it at least were that while his parents were very strict, God-fearing pietists, from influenced by Danish and German pietists, he felt a lot of love there. It was kind of run like a co-op with all these kids. They all worked hard to contribute to the well-being of the family, Monday to Saturday, but Sunday was strictly observed for rest and worship. There was every day time for devotion, scripture memorization, and family singing in the evening. Spiritually, his influences were fairly narrow. So the Danish pietist Erik von Toppedon, Johann Arndt, one of the German forerunners of pietism, and of course Kingo's hymn book were kind of his most significant influences, and the Bible that he carried with him even during his work. I mentioned yesterday that during his childhood, Haugi's spirituality had a somewhat brooding character to it. He nearly drowned twice in the Glommen River and was rescued by family members, and these near-death experiences left a rather sort of traumatic stress effect on his life, where he was very anxious about the possibility of dying, first of all, and then of dying suddenly, perhaps out of favor with God, perhaps, you know, in a state of sin or not having fully repented of his sin, and felt that if he did die in such a state, he would be certainly cast into hell. And so that cast a pall over, certainly over his spirituality. Although he lived a very devout life, that dread didn't really pass until a day in April 1796, when he was about 25, and he was working in the field. He began to sing a hymn, Jesus, I long for thy blessed communion. And he sang that second verse, all that I am and possess, I surrender. Thou, only thou, canst my sadness dispel. And he says he suddenly saw with deep sorrow the depth of his sin and of the world lying sunken in evil, he says, over which I grieved greatly. And he had a feeling of great despair that washed over him, as though, well, it doesn't matter what I do. Honestly, this sin is bigger than I am. And he says it was at that moment of despair that he was lifted out of himself as the love and the grace of God overwhelmed him. And he said, I felt awakening in me an inner burning love for God and for the neighbor, and a deep desire to share that grace, that good news with others. And so he began almost immediately gathering Bonder in small groups, in homes, inviting them to read the scriptures, to pray together, talking about preaching repentance and the grace of God. And there was a powerful response. These were a people who had lost hope, who believed that their condition was a sign that God had abandoned them, and found in Haughey's preaching and presence a genuine hope, not just for themselves spiritually after death, but very much a concrete hope for their lives in this world. Now, as Haughey began to do this traveling, he always informed the clergy in the places where he was, because that was the law. But as the response to his work grew, those clergy became less and less compliant and much more and more worried about what he was doing. And frequently he would rail against government and church corruption, which of course was not popular with the pastors. And some of Haughey's hearers, who were younger and more aggressive, began to strike out preaching on their own. And you can see how the church would regard this as an extremely dangerous movement. And often families and parishes were thrown into conflict. You know, some would receive Haughey's preaching and teaching, and others would think, no, this is really dangerous, and it would cause some splits. And for a while, Haughey himself wondered if this is really what God wanted him to be doing. It wasn't actually that long, just about a year after he began his work, that Christmas of 1797, that his first arrest was set in motion by Pastor Fairman in Fredrikstad. And that arrest was followed by numerous arrests over the years until he was eventually imprisoned, finally, for 8 years without trial in truly a hellhole of a prison. And then two more years of hard labor afterwards. What's interesting is that while the later arrests were carried out on the premise that he violated the Conventicle Act, in other words, that he was gathering people without a pastor's permission to look at the scriptures, it was initially Haughey's economic activities that got him into trouble. Haughey, from a young age, was handy and inventive and kind of a natural entrepreneur. He Albertan pie. He would have fit right into kind of the Alberta pietist scene here. And by the time he reached his late teens, he was known throughout the area for the quality of his work in carpentry, as a blacksmith, broommaker, raising bees, trading stock, bookbinding, inventing new ways of raising crops. He had eventually knitting mittens when he had all these others taken from him by the government. These enterprises, in fact, were so successful that he came to own a house in Bergen, a ship and its cargo. And then, being a merchant and being required to travel, he was, of course, also then able to do his preaching and gathering of folks around the country. And as he traveled, he began to see how widespread the poverty was among the Bonder, and became very deeply disturbed by it. And he felt strongly that Christian compassion compelled him to do something about this beyond simply the preaching. And thought, well, maybe initially he thought, he was doing a lot of writing at the time. 33 books popped out just one after the other. It's so embarrassing for me to think of him being able to do that on top of all that he was doing. But anyway, I'm sure not that productive. And he thought, well, maybe I could start a publishing house. I could practically supply it with my own writing, you know. And he wanted to do it as a co-op, right? So he would gather some of these folks together and organize themselves. They would each own the thing, and they would run it kind of like a commune, basically, I guess you'd say, sort of along the lines of the early church in Acts 2 and Acts 4. And the licensing authorities got wind of this and refused to grant him a license for the publishing house, but he eventually managed to do the same thing, realizing that publishers need paper, with a printing not with a printing press, but rather with a paper mill. So he eventually did get a paper mill organized and in Eicher. And along with similar enterprises, they were organized in a way that the working families benefited from the profits, and the sick and elderly were cared for, and a real genuine community of faith and work grew up around them. It reminds me in some ways of the base Christian communities a little bit that developed in Latin America, that maybe not difference in other ways, but there was a deep sense that there was a very small elite group in the country that was, you know, that there were some resistance needed to be developed, and a willingness to study the scriptures together each day and to see how they apply to our daily life. It was this point at which resistance to Hauge was the greatest, and oddly enough, it came from his friends as much as from authorities. His friends were disturbed that Hauge should be so concerned with worldly enterprises. You know, we're just preparing people to leave this body behind and go on to the glory afterwards. In fact, many of them had actually sold their farms and their businesses for this purpose, to kind of prepare for the life to come. And they had wandered around preaching until, of course, they were completely destitute and forced to rely on the people that hadn't sold their farms and their businesses to do the Lord's business. So Hauge responded in his letters to them by saying that the practical work that he was doing was one of the ways in which he furthered God's glory on earth and worked for the benefit of the neighbor. And he developed a concept he called joint stewardship. So it was a system of elders in various places whose job was to ensure that both the economic and spiritual well-being of his followers were being taken care of. In his autobiography, Hauge writes, "It was my heartfelt desire to benefit others and provide people with jobs without regard to personal glory or self-interest." The problem for the authorities, and I think we can certainly sympathize with them on this, is that there are numerous and hideous examples of religious leaders using a controlling spirituality to line their own pockets. You know, so money and religion, they're put together, looks like a potentially dangerous combination. Not so different from what the State Church of Norway actually had been doing, but of course that wasn't in their line of sight. And so, for example, a letter by J.N. Brun, written from Bergen in October of 1810 to the County Supreme Court attorney in Christiana, shows some of these concerns. He writes, "Nearly all of Hauge's followers are miserable weaklings, the least influential part of the Commonwealth, and really could never become dangerous to the state. But it may be that their economic enterprises are a matter that the government should investigate. It's entirely possible that they are wolves in sheep's clothing, that blunders are being made, and perhaps even frauds being perpetrated," right? So, and Joseph Shaw, in this old book, Pulpit Under the Sky, it quotes Vera Steen, who writes about this. He says, as intolerant as this age was, still they would reluctantly judge a man because he was rescuing souls outside of the law's jurisdiction. But it was much easier to seize one who carried trade on outside of the law. And so, for example, when some of Hauge's employees in Melangen used some of the profits from their work for evangelistic purposes and gave Hauge the responsibility of distributing those funds, they saw that as Hauge's control of, you know, he was somehow using them to gain funds which he would use for his own purposes, although that was never really identified. But thought there was enough suspicion there that he had stepped outside of the law, that he was charged as being in violation of business law. And that's when his home, his shipping business, and the rest was confiscated, and he was reduced to knitting mittens to keep himself alive. In the end, though, what put him in jail for a long period of time was his gathering of the Bonder for religious meetings. And if you're facing a hungry population that's in a revolutionary mood, they couldn't afford to have Hauge bringing people together in these kind of groups, even if it was just to pray. And so it was the violation of the Conventicle Act then that landed him in prison. In his autobiography, Hauge reports about the conversation that he had with the bailiff on his way to prison. He says, "Since the bailiff, as I experienced, did not care for my religious conversation, I spoke mostly with him of various projects for the public good, of which I, here and there in the country, had been the initiator. And I said, it's sad to think that they should all be shipwrecked. Many people are going to lose their livelihoods. But I suppose, even concerning that, I'll be at peace if only I'm satisfied that I've done what I could for the benefit of my homeland and my fellow men's benefit, both temporal and eternal." So, you know, his feeling that he had been given a responsibility from God for the care of these folks that was holistic, that was, you know, both physical and spiritual. And but it was sad, he said, to think that now, as from the loss of this leadership, some of these are going to fail. In the middle of his imprisonment, ironically, the British blockaded the Norwegian ports, as I mentioned, to keep them from trading. And that embargo was very, very painful for Norway. And the Norwegians looked around and they said, we've got to find somebody that can help us out with this. And the worst problem they were facing was the salt embargo, because it happened to be that in the first year of that embargo, the crops failed. And so the people were reduced to eating bread made of rye flour and pulverized tree bark. And even the food that they had couldn't be preserved because they couldn't get salt. So there was widespread sickness and starvation. And so after having clapped Hauge in jail for his economic and spiritual enterprises, they decided that they needed an entrepreneur like him, and they released him from jail on the condition that his family post a bond, just in case, which they did, and ordered him to set up salt factories along the shore. So he established a number of salt factories along the southern and western coasts of Norway. The latter years of his imprisonment after the trial were at hard labor, and he was fairly broken in health physically by the time he got out. And yet, he still continued to resist that embargo. So at the Backe farm, where he was living, he introduced potatoes. And turned out that the potatoes went really well. And then he rigged up a mill along the Akers River, and he used it to grind grain for the military garrison nearby, and they would give him some of the grain if he ground theirs. And then he bought some fish from friends in western Norway, and then he took the potatoes and the grain and the fish and basically used it as a food bank. He alleviated the starving of hundreds in his region as long as that embargo lasted, and restored some measure of hope and dignity to those folks. He died in 1824 at the age of 53, truly broken in health from this imprisonment, and to some extent broken in heart too. He married after he got out for the first time, and he'd only been married a year when his wife gave birth. She got pregnant fairly shortly after their wedding and then died in childbirth. And he married again a few years later, but all three of the children born to his second wife died before they were 5 years old. So he only had one surviving son, the one in which his first wife died. And he didn't see many of his dreams realized, but in lots of ways his work ignited a movement that contributed to widespread change in Norwegian society and in the lives of the Bonder. And I just want to briefly highlight those before we talk about our Canadian situation. First of all, Hauge supported the role of women as leaders in his movement, in part because of his work. It was simple. They were meeting at homes most of the time, and this, for the Bonder, was their place of responsibility and authority. They were hosts. And so the women became very often the leaders, or certainly large contributors to these conventicles, and weren't happy, got used to expressing their voice, and did so then in the years following his death. And in part because of his work, single women in Norway were given the right to manage their own affairs without an older male or even younger male looking after them in 1845, so about 20 years after his death. By 1880, were legally equal with men. So the fairly rapid changes certainly predates anything that happened over here. Hauge's pressures on the church control of religion led to the beginnings of ecumenism. It led to the passing of the Dissenter Law, which granted freedom for Christian religions, not non-Christian religions at that point, but certainly for other Christian groups. A law was passed in 1842 granting freedom of trade, preventing some of the trade abuses that the bonder had suffered at the hands of aristocrats and foreign investors. And perhaps most significantly, a network of political and social connections was set up by Hauge's travels across Norway that became the base for which political parties developed. And labor unions can be attributed to the influence that Hauge had there. So there was a kind of a powerfully democratizing influence that he had on Norway. Comes out of a couple of things, I think. He taught the bonder that a Christian may disobey earthly authorities when those authorities are clearly in conflict with God's word. And I think he demonstrated a courage that I don't often see among Canadians. We gladly give our, well, not gladly, but we always give our taxes each year, even though we are often deeply opposed to the ways in which those taxes are used. And we'd be put in jail, I suppose, or whatever. There'd be consequences if we didn't pay them. But the willingness to resist that and the courage and the obligation to resist that which we don't think is consonant with God's word was something that Hauge implanted in the Norwegian people that I think we could recover a piece of. Secondly, he gave the bonder the tools they needed to participate politically. Because when they were converted under Hauge's preaching, then they had to read the Bible. But most couldn't read, right? So they had to learn how to read. Once they learned how to read the Bible, they started reading other things, the newspapers, the various books and so on that were circulating. In those small groups, Hauge taught them the value of their own opinion. These conventicles, these small groups, became mediating structures in which they could try out their voice and share their opinions in a fairly safe setting. And as they gained some courage sharing it in those settings, they could then take it into the more into the scarier and larger public arena. In many ways, the voice of the bonder resulted in the abolition of the nobility and basically a semi-democratic constitution after Norway's secession from Denmark to Sweden, handed over from one to the other, in 1814. If you have an educated peasant class, it's a lot harder to claim that, well, we're ruling, you know, the aristocracy is ruling because we're the only people that really know what's going on. I mean, if your people know what's going on, it's a little harder to claim that privilege. So in many ways, it was during Hauge's time and just after that Norway found and articulated itself as a nation. I don't mean to imply that all these changes are due to him. You know, I think the Spirit of God had been very active in Norway during that period, and there were a number of others who contributed their piece into the changes. And there were similar changes occurring in other parts of Europe, too. So, but I think he had a very significant catalytic effect. Eventually, Hauge's followers came to the U.S. Most of those that came here came through the States. And they were received by an American Lutheranism that had already been strongly influenced by German Pietism. Our sort of founder of, what we might call the founder of American Lutheranism, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, I got twigged to this by Vince Erickson, had been trained at the Halle Mission, a Pietist center in Germany, and came to the Carolinas and had already begun to set up a form of Lutheranism that had lots of Pietist characteristics to it. Many Haugians then moved up from the States, particularly around the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, looking for cheaper land mostly. And George Evensen pulled some of that story together, you know, together in his history of the church in Canada. The Haughey Synod's first settlements were in central Alberta, the Bardo district. So those of you who know Bardo Lutheran Church in Tofield, that's kind of the still remaining remnant of that. It was Beresvend Anderson, and I went to a Bible school, I think, with one of his descendants, Faye Anderson. He then organized the Scandia congregation in Armina, 1901. 1905, T.T. Carlson, whom I know we have some descendants of in this congregation, began work in Camrose and Ball, in Dinant, in Haylakes, Round Hill, Kingman, and New Norway. And I believe there's still churches in Lutheran churches in all of those places. These were all Haughey churches, although Messiah and Balf and New Norway also merged with other groups. And then Pastor Hjortis started the congregation in Riley in 1908, and then he went on from there to organize Sharon in Calgary. And you'll recognize these. If you know these congregations, you'll see that Haughey character to them, right? They have a certain, there's something about them that you can tell from one to the other. Central Lutheran in Edmonton, similar. They're still active. And then in 1911, some of the Tofield folks went up to Peace River country and started the town of Valhalla. Norwegian heaven. And it was Chester Ronning's father, Halvor, another Haughey, who had retired from his mission work in China, and he began the Lutheran congregations up there. So that's a wee bit of, in a very compressed way, a bit of a history. I want to spend the rest of my time talking about the implications of Haughey's legacy for the Canadian church and for our own Canadian context. And I mean, that's really a large conversation, so I'm just offering my opinion on these matters. I'd like to look at three elements of Haughey's work. And while I recognize that they may have been distorted or sometimes even lost, sometimes in the trip across the Atlantic, sometimes in the history of the people that came, nonetheless, I think these hold real promise for revitalizing our church in Canadian society, and I think they're worth recovering or strengthening. The three are, the first, the public nature of his faith. Secondly, his emphasis on the formation and leadership of the laity. And finally, his view of the church. First, Haughey's public faith, his integration of faith and work. Those early Norwegian immigrants brought with them Haughey's emphasis on industry and hard work. This is ironic because when the first immigrants began to come from Norway, the American Lutherans were dismayed. The Norwegians had a reputation of being Viking-like, you know, sort of corrupt, carousing, you know, not the sort that you'd really want in the new country you were trying to build, right? But when the Haugians showed up and turned out to be actually fairly good, God-fearing, decent folks, that changed their opinion. So they had an early effect. Anyway, that industry and hard work ethic was fairly prevalent among the early settlers here. Helped them make it through the really hard days of pioneering on the prairies. And I don't know exactly what to put this up to, but I would say probably the individualism and competition so characteristic of North American capitalism, I think in some ways undid that cooperative emphasis that Haughey had, that emphasis on forming, you know, economic co-ops. There were a number of these, of course, on the prairies that formed early on, but they kind of disappeared as we got into the mid part of the 20th century. What they did create, though, and persisted in creating, and which are present all around this area, are a number of institutions for health and long-term care. And that's been one of the persistent gifts of the Haugians to the, not just the Haugians, but certainly them. That Haughey emphasis on faith, active, and love, as Luther would have put it, is essential to reclaim, I think, for a couple of reasons. First of all, because committed Christians who don't have their eyes turned outwards towards their neighbor in a gracious way will tend to have them turn inward. And deep faith can be distorted into a deep concern, a deep self-centered concern for preserving one's personal purity and piety. And Luther defined that being curved in on oneself essentially as the essence of sin. I've seen people, I've known people who claimed a Haugian heritage who have done great harm to another person, but in the process of being confronted about the harm, are only concerned about their own guilt and the stain that has appeared on their character as a result of what's been done, not about the harm that's been done to the neighbor. In other words, not about the effect that this has had on the neighbor and how that might be healed. Right? In other words, it reminds me of what Bonhoeffer said as he was going back to Germany for the last time from his work in New York, and he was, you know, thinking about whether or not he should get involved in this plot to assassinate Hitler. And he said, he finally decided that if I can spare some of my brothers and sisters, Jewish brothers and sisters, from the horror that's being carried out upon them, he said, I'm willing to risk hell. In other words, to preserve one's own purity at the expense of the neighbor, it's not what love is about. It wasn't about that for Hauge. But it has occasionally been, I think, a piece of our own history. So there are some stories that of that sort that need to be told, and there are some hurts that need to be healed around that. And Canadian Pietists have certainly been criticized for this emphasis on morally correct behavior. And to be honest, Hauge had a good share of it himself, at least early on in his life. He had a pattern of piety so scrupulous at the beginning that at one point he considered laughter unbecoming for a Christian, let alone dancing, or drinking, or card playing, which seemed to be the big three. But he got a little wiser as he got older, and I'll just share a few examples. When his friends criticized his impious involvements, for example, in business, Hauge said, again, the Bible's injunction to deny the world means resisting destructive temptations and figuring out, with careful reflection, which temptations truly were destructive, right? Which were making not despising life in the body or despising the world that God loves. It is in the world, he said, that God's mission happens and God's glory is realized. We're called to participate in that mission. As I'm doing this rural work, I see more and more, and especially in the last few days, how that my own Haugian sort of influences have affected the way that I've decided to do my own ministry. I'm sort of recognizing some things about myself in this process. When Hauge was released from prison, his friends were scandalized by some of his behavior as they got to meet him again and see how he was behaving. For example, now to support himself, he was still knitting mittens, but he was knitting fancy mittens. Imagine that. And shaving and traveling on Sundays. And shaving on a Sunday. And in his later years, he served wine on festive occasions at the Bakke farm. And then in 1818, we found a letter in which he is being rebuked for one of his followers for having a brandy still at his home. And Hauge replies that he hadn't found that making brandy was a sin, but if he ever did come to that opinion, he would chop his boilers to pieces at once. So it was about discerning what was really helpful and what was really hurtful. It wasn't about a simple sort of cheap setting of rules. After visiting his followers in Numendal, Hauge writes that a fair number of them were so strict in their self-denial that I had to remind them often they ought not to discard the innocent along with the blameworthy. I mentioned yesterday about those that upbraided him for walking. He was a guy with a lot of energy. He was always walking briskly and confidently, and They were worried that this might appear too worldly to people that that met him, and so they suggested that he might want to walk more like John Hogglestad, which was another lay preacher who kind of meandered along like he had the weight of the world on his shoulders and his, kept his head down. And so how he... Yeah, okay, he said, oh, that's good advice, you know. And so for a week, he just really laid into that, you know, and slouched along and pulled down the corner of his mouth and did his caricature of Hogglestad until his friends finally begged him to desist and let the old Haugie come back, which he happily did. That sort of joie de vivre didn't always make it across the ocean, and honestly, sometimes our Canadian pietists have been better known for their avoidance of dancing and drinking than for their joy in the Lord or their social activism. I remember my first week at Bible school, which was a wonderful sort of immersion into a life of a Bible study, of deep faith, of community. But I do remember one thing that kind of stuck out when one evening they put on, somebody had a record on in the lounge, you know, and a couple of girls got up, one who eventually turned up to be my wife, and started dancing. And, you know, and it wasn't intergender dancing, just they were just having some fun. But we got a fairly stern lecture then the next morning in class about, you know, how, who knows whether, at least if, it wasn't that bad a thing to do, but what if somebody walking by saw it was happening and brought disrepute on the gospel? So anyway, so that there's a bit of that. In lots of ways, Haugians were concerned about the cheap grace, and I'll talk about that in a minute, which they saw in the church in Norway. But they themselves were sometimes guilty of what I'd call cheap holiness. And that is a holiness that depends on simple rules to ensure that one is actually living a life that reflects love for God and the neighbor. Loving others is a really difficult and complex thing that requires a lot of close observation and listening and conversation and difficult action and not always sure what's the best thing, right? And cheap holiness is that sort of like the Pharisees, you know, that depends on just having a nice, simple set of rules that will ensure that I'm living purely and effectively, and I don't have to pay too much of attention to my neighbor as long as I'm doing or not doing these prohibited or required things. Second reason why I think that integration of faith and work is so important for Canadians is that in my experience, conversation in Canada about public policy does not generally engage the deep worldviews that make us tick. Maybe it's a desire to avoid conflict or some distortion of multiculturalism, but it was surprising for me to be in Germany in 99 and listening to the radio or TV, and there'd be some issue would come up on the news, and then immediately they'd go to some theologian or philosopher who'd go on for 10 or 15 minutes, you know, about what the deep meaning of this is in relation to human life and how we understand what the good is and so forth. It never happens. It rarely happens in Canada, right? When I was doing my interviews with bankrupt farmers, I quickly found that there's a kind of a deep belief in Canada that if you get rid of the weak ones, a community will get stronger. A survival of the fittest kind of a philosophy that was actually deeply embedded in the way in which farm support programs and other things were set up. But nobody was speaking to that particular philosophy. It wasn't being debated or challenged as to whether or not that's a sustainable worldview that can actually keep our communities healthy. It was just kind of a behind-the-scenes operation. We talked pragmatically about numbers and figures and so forth, but that engagement of what we believe about the world with what's actually happening wasn't going on. And Haugie wasn't afraid to take his faith directly into the public arena. Yet Christians don't believe that when the weak leave the community gets stronger. They think that survival of the fittest is an extinction philosophy. I mean, if only the fittest survive, how many do you have left? At the end, you know, just one. And they can't reproduce, right? So it's an extinction philosophy. And We know that God's chosen the weak, as Paul says, and how he was criticized frequently for allowing the weak into these conventicles, people that were disreputable and shouldn't be in there, and him saying, no, you know, the grace of God is for everybody. And when we have the weak in our midst, we get stronger. Children, for example, are basically parasites till they're about 18. And yet, because they're in our midst, we have to build schools and set up sports teams and all kinds of adult relationships and even economic arrangements get formed, and the community gets stronger. When you have the weak elderly in your community, you learn to care for them, but you in the process also learn to care for each other. When you keep your law breakers in the community, don't just ship them off for storage in some distant prison, then you have to learn accountability. How do we actually create the conditions in this place to hold people accountable and responsible for their behavior? You grow up as a community morally. And so learning how to address the deep worldviews that are behind the policies our government makes requires us taking our faith straightforwardly into the public arena. And I think Haugi's got a given us a good example for that. Yeah. I think that churches that don't take their faith and their work out into their communities are withholding gifts from the very place they're most needed. And a public gospel in these small rural church communities that I work in, they often are corporately depressed. They don't feel as if they have any power to determine their own futures, and as if the forces that are allied against them, economically, politically, and otherwise, are going to crush them. That there's just kind of a black, the future's kind of a black hole or a tunnel leading down to extinction sometimes. And so they don't try, they don't identify and mobilize the resources that are there, and they don't try new things because they think it's a waste of time. But the gospel, a public gospel, says, hey, we believe that there's a God out there who's bigger than these things, and we can afford to try a few things because even if we fail, we're still beloved people of great value. It's not going to have cast any reflection on our worth as a community or on us. So let's give it a shot. And when there is that kind of hope, people do try, and turns out that the odd thing actually works, and life grows up, right? And that's kind of the conviction behind the Ronning Center, I think, and also behind Circle M, this center that I'm working with, that taking these gifts into the public sphere is a way of building healthy communities, just as Haugi believed. The second element of his legacy that I think is essential to the revitalization of our church is his emphasis on the discipleship and leadership of the laity. And I think I mentioned to the group yesterday, my first home visit here, I had a great visit with older Norwegian lady, and at the end then I wanted to have prayer with her, as I always did, and we talked about some things that I thought we could lift up in prayer, and I'm sitting there trying to think of what to say, and then all of a sudden she breaks in and starts praying. And I was shocked. This had never happened to me in my pastoral practice before, that she would have the temerity, you know, to jump in there and pray, the confidence to do that, the ability to do that, right? And I discovered it was common in this place, where these Haugians had learned that that Christian discipleship and the skills of Christian life were theirs. And they weren't afraid to exercise them. And that prayer ministry has been a big part of the history of this place and other Haugian congregations, where they have really learned how to share their concerns, their loves, their sorrows for themselves, for each other, and for the world in prayer. I also found that a relatively independent network of small group Bible studies existed here, and that there were hundreds that had gone through, more than half the congregation had gone through some kind of a very formal and intensive long-term thing, like the Bethel Bible series and the Search series and the Divine Drama, and it was a pretty articulate group of people. I was a little scared getting up there to preach for quite a long time until I realize that they're mostly fairly kind to me. It's a young 20-something pastor trying to tell all these wise, older Christians who've been living their whole life in the Scriptures, you know, what they what they should be thinking. Although I did discover right off the bat that they did have their own opinions and weren't necessarily going to take what I said at face value. We were getting used to a new liturgy that had a few theological additions to it, or changes, and one was the line in the Confession of Sin that says we are in bondage to sin and can't free ourselves. Hauge's all about, you know, addressing those who talk the talk but don't walk the walk, right? And the line from the confession seems to imply it's impossible to conform one's life to the gospel no matter how hard one tries. At least that was the impression some had. And it was hard for a pietist to swallow. And so, immediately after the service, two respected lay people independently took me aside. Being new, I guess this was an opportunity to voice this again, and strongly expressed their discomfort with the in bondage to sin language. And I realized very quickly they had, you know, they were articulate. You know, I was kind of backed into a corner there. I wasn't quite sure how I was going to deal with that. Either we had to talk about dropping this new confession or finding a way that offered some room for sanctification in the whole experience. And so I tried to work that in. I don't know how successfully. I think some just never said that part of the confession thereafter. But anyway, what I discovered was that my own authority was not enough to determine an issue. The interpretation of Scripture, in other words, was not something to be dictated by clergy, but something to be worked out in a community of theologically competent people. And they weren't afraid to share their opinions with me. This interest in reading the Bible, developing one's own capacity, and forming their own opinions, I think is important for a couple of reasons. It's important to our culture in kind of a sense, in that Northrop Frye, one of our great literary critics, once said that the loss of biblical literacy in Canada, whether you're Christian or not, among average Canadians means that one day most of us will no longer be able to understand the great classics of the West because they're embedded with biblical allusions. But of course, it's even more serious for the church. Increasingly, our candidates for ministry, the people coming into the front end of the seminary, really deeply need catechization. In other words, they don't have the stories and the narratives of the scriptures sort of soaked into their thinking. Theological reflection is mostly this process of, you know, I don't go to somebody's bedside and say, oh, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, I'm sure there's something in the Bible, or perhaps in Moltmann, that would apply to your situation. If you just let me go home and look at, you know, look through my commentaries, I'm sure I'll have something useful to say to you. You know, no, it has to sort of saturate your thinking. You have to be able to see their life and help them see their lives inside the frame of these stories. And it reinterprets what this whole experience is about that they're going through in a way that they can deal with it redemptively. And that work is not going to happen, plus all the training for Christian leadership in the 3 years that we actually have them at the seminary. That's just not going to happen. So that has to happen in our congregations before they ever get there. That leadership development has to happen, not just for the sake of the clergy, but for the sake of Christian life in the world. Oh, I got to tell you one little story from... So 1 year we decided to have a Faith Works group here, where we had people from their workplaces meet and talk about how their faith reframes their work experience. And Dr. George Evenson, beloved pillar of this community, was there. And there's also a massage therapist in the group. And I had never had a massage, and I sort of saw it in kind of the massage parlor sort of a thing, that a slightly seedy occupation. And who volunteers, first of all, to take us to their workplace but the massage therapist, right? And so, I've just been like, oh, why did I start this? I'm sure this is going to be a bad experience. What a reputation I'm going to have, you know, after we go to the... Anyway, off we go to the massage parlor. Massage therapist. My pietist group's coming through. And she shows us, you know, all that she does and explains her work to us and so on. And we're sitting there afterwards, We'd been using the Lord's Prayer, as a kind of a frame for our thinking. How's God honored here? How are the needs of the world met? What needs to be forgiven, and so on. But initially, just thinking, what does this mean that's going on? What's God trying to do here? Honestly, I'm totally blank. George sits there a minute and he says, "This is confession and absolution." He said, "When somebody comes in here, all the pain and the hurt of the world." Just remember him saying that. All the pain and the hurt of the world has gotten embedded in the muscles of their body. And they expose that to someone. And it's troubling and slightly shameful. But they touch that body with gentleness and with grace. Sometimes there's some tears. It hurts a bit to have those places touched. Sometimes a lot. But when they come out, they're free. There's a sense of absolution that comes, and they move out into the world with a new freedom to engage it again. And that woman looked at George and said, with tears in her eyes, "I will never see my work the same again." Why don't we do that for every single person, whether we're students or plumbers? We ought to be able to go into our work and see how God, the Spirit, is moving in this place and building communities through us, right? That was one of Hauge's geniuses, and it requires the kind of biblical training and sort of immersion in the life and narratives of the church that makes that possible. And finally, Hauge's view of the church, and I want to give you some time to respond too, so I'll not spend too much longer on this, but Hauge's critique of the church was never intended to be a critique of liturgy and order as if somehow that was inherently a bad thing, or the sacraments as if they had no value. What he was worried about was the treatment of it as a kind of magical spectacle that somehow just by being present and observing would result in all kinds of good things happening to you. And he would call it a kind of a sin against grace. And it's not the grace that discovers God's mercy at the point of despair in oneself. He said it's a kind of a high-handedness that treats God as a kind of a butler, that expects that God will be on hand to deal with whatever little things you need to be dealt with when you want him to, but not around when you don't want him to interfere. It's kind of like a handy servant, right? It's not the grace which one finds when one surrenders one's own judgment to God's, often in despair of oneself or the world, but a grace that glosses over the harm that one is doing, leaving oneself unchanged. Not treating God as the Lord of life, but as a divine butler or maybe a divine agent setting up weekly entertainments for us through his clergy clients. So how he can speak of people embracing idolatry in their church going and reading and prayers and songs. And he says, "Alas, what does it help to pray and to read and to be baptized and to receive the sacrament of the Lord's Supper? It's all so much foolishness." Those are really, really strong words. And yet Hauge himself was a regular churchgoer right to the end of his life, even after the church and the government took away his livelihood and put him into jail for 10 years. In his final years in the Bakke farm, we still got the fantastic how the Scandinavians keep records of these things, but we still got his name still appears on the list of communicants at the Gamla Aker Church. And when his followers took his critique of the church as a reason to stop attending, what he was wanting for was a fuller experience of the thing, and despising the sacraments, he then writes in his collected sermons, "Remember the saints who had fellowship with God in his holy temple and honored his sacraments for the purpose God had intended and used them with hearts dedicated to him." He just wanted a passionate Christianity, engaged Christianity, a repentant and hopeful and gracious Christianity. He had no desire to abandon the church. He wanted the church to equip its people with that powerful word of life, to move away from a culture Christianity that was lived like a spectator sport, where the clergy are kind of the heroes on the stage and the only real practitioners, and where the people are just there to fill the seats and the coffers. He wanted to recover the church as a powerful bringer of a word that forms and transforms our relationships with God and others. And I have, in my work with rural churches, become convinced that we, not just Haughey, but still, we, the church in Canada, have been in bondage to a very, very old form of oppression that began within a few centuries of the Christian church's inauguration. You know, Constantine's famous conversion, Constantine was a general in the Roman army who, shortly after the worst persecution of Christians in their history, in the period from around 303 to 311 under Diocletian, Roman commander Constantine, at the Battle of Milvian Bridge, looks up to the sun and he sees a cross of light above it, along with the Greek words "en tuto nika," by this conquer, and he wins the battle and decides that he won it because of that cross, and then has the cross painted then on all of the shields and so forth that he carries up from that point on. And he was a very powerful patron of the church, and in many ways shaped the church in, I think, the trappings of the Roman Empire. I think he twisted the faith of the crucified one, the faith of the few and the weak, who according to Paul are the ones that God has chosen, into kind of a banner for the empire, and a religious cloak of the empire's ambitions to size and to strength and to power. And so the many cathedrals that we have around the world, in some ways, are, I believe, and this is my opinion, please argue with me, but have more in common with the spectacle of the Colosseum, in which so many Christians were slaughtered, than they do with the small faith-forming groups of the early church. Even when thousands were converted, they met in homes, in groups small enough to do deep discipleship. And if you go to the Rome today, you'll see my kids were over there recently, and they saw that the Colosseum is missing a lot of its stone, right? Where did all that stone go? It's in the churches now. And it might seem like a good recycling of what was kind of a horrific arena experience, but in some ways, the churches built with those bloody stones have turned out to be too much like the Colosseum itself. And the love of strength and size and power has become the mark of the church. And so whenever we have more people attend something, we assume that that's a mark of success, right? And no church decides to get smaller so that it can be can do deeper work and its people can know each other and love each other better. And every seminarian who comes to seminary discovers that preaching in front of a bunch of people that have all their eyes turned on him or her, like yours are turned on me now, gets a lot of satisfaction from that. And that, by golly, I must be called to the ministry. In other words, being the sage on the stage is a remarkably great thing, and having the people watch and approve that rather than themselves carrying out the ministry is really great. So I think in some ways that model of the church is a great theater, filled to the brim, gathered around a marvelous religious spectacle and flush with money, you know, is the dream. I was in Chicago. What's the name of that church? Really big one. Willow Creek. And it's enormous. It's like a mall with several sanctuaries and bookstores. And anyway, so I'm talking to one of the churches pastors afterwards. And it was fantastic theater. And afterwards I said to one of the pastors, "Well, how has this been for you?" And he said, "You know, honestly, some days I just feel as though I'm touching 1,000 lives about that deep, and I just long to be able to work with a few this much." Well, there's a place where that's happening. It's out on the prairies near Cutknife. That little church has 100% attendance. Well, occasionally somebody gets sick, and then everybody goes to visit the one that gets sick, but it's basically 100% attendance. And they regularly gather, and they open the scriptures, and they talk about what's happened in their lives this week and what does that mean in relationship to this scripture. And it's not Lutheran. And there's so a priest comes around occasionally and will help them sort through some issues of whatever it is, tough theological nuggets in the scriptures or dispenses sacraments or pulls them together with other groups in the region for some kind of a celebration. And very active in their community. And they love working together for stuff that makes a difference. So this little church, its leaders should be being called into conventions, right, to talk about how my secrets for deep discipleship, right? Isn't this a sort of the life that Christians are expected to lead? But that little church is on the verge of being shut down because it's not big enough, right? They want to close it. And that kind of Constantinian captivity of the church, I think, is something that needs to be resisted. This is a lovely, large congregation, but one of the reasons that I could be a pastor here was because there were so many places in which those small, intimate, deep discipleship experiences were happening. And I couldn't ever be in a congregation like Willow Creek, although I know they try to do small group stuff too. But we already have that happening in so many places, and those places are despised. And those are the places where Haugian Pietism took its roots, from that same despising of those people and their ignorant Christianity. Out of that has come a revival as he began to help them revalue themselves in the light of God and one another, and develop the skills for exercising their voice publicly. So I just want to let you imagine what the church might be if our people discovered the scriptures again, as difficult as they are. Haugi was never a kind of, this is a biblical rule and answer book, right? His faith was not in the Bible. His faith was in the living Lord, who used that Bible in the same passage in very different ways, often quite devotionally. You know, what's God saying to me today in this place? Or, boy, this is a tough thing, and it's sure contrary what's being said over here. And he wouldn't have any trouble identifying the deep tensions and often deep contradictions sometimes in scriptures, because his faith was in the Spirit who wielded the word, and he trusted that the engagement with that word would result in some deep personal growth in his spiritual life. And it did. And he knew it deeply. It reminds me of Arnold Hagen, having memorized pretty well that whole book, you know, out there on the trackers. That was kind of Haugi's life, letting it soak deep into our core. So what might our church look like, and what might our communities look like if we took some of those Haugian gifts a little more seriously? Well, sorry for how long this has been, but I would like you to then tell me. You're the experts, really, in a lot of ways about the Haugian experience here in central Alberta. So what's been your experience? What kind of things I've said that might have twigged some deeply concerned response or a comment or question? At the back?
I'm just going to say, I am one of those that was massacred in the Colosseum. I left the structure 17 years ago.
Oh. Interesting. Thank you. Greg, you had something?
Okay. Emma, in December of 2006 for the Canada Lutheran, you wrote a piece called Peace and Piety. And near the end, you say, Pietism isn't a program or a church structure. It is the Spirit moving us to love Jesus, love others, to feed that love with Bible study, prayer, and hard work on others' behalf. Similar to what I heard tonight. Don Neville, in December of that same year, who was Pastor Highwood and was on the Synod Worship Committee, in his response to you writes, Pietism has been a very mixed blessing to Lutheranism, and one that most of us would have just done fine without. So my question before you, as a teacher of, or at the seminary, a person who's been an articulate advocate for Pietism, is this In your opinion or in your discernment in the contemporary scene today, outside of the sociological reality that you presented, how can this Lutheran pietistic life or community reclaim, promote, and present an enthusiasm that brings back the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, into the lives of people without falling prey to distortions therein, so that we have the power that meets the form, because you have articulated that in an article, or in the end, is it just left it to just sort of do these things?
Well, I mean, you're asking me how God's going to do God's job, probably. I mean, that's probably bigger than I can respond. But certainly, I was telling Harold that when our dean interviewed each of our professors and asked them, what do you want to see in your seminarians when they come to seminary? And all of them said, the first thing we want to see is a deep understanding of an immersion in the Scriptures. In other words, to know the Bible well. And finding some ways of just simply doing that basic catechetical work. I've always appreciated the students that have come out of the Bible school training, simply because they know the Scriptures. And if they have struggle, I mean, our job is to help them think broadly and globally and incisively about the Scriptures and learn how to pass it on to others and so forth. Now, that's kind of the seminary training piece, but that basic catechetical piece can't really be done there. And so starting with finding ways to do Bible school has been a great gift to me. When I think back of all my training, honestly, this is not an exaggeration, the single one thing that's done more for my work as a professor and as a pastor and as a person has been just that I got soaked in the Scriptures at Bible school and had an old German pastor who, in our confirmation program, made us memorize hundreds of hymns and Bible passages, and those things were absorbed into my system and became part of who I am. And so we've got such a weak discipline around the training of our young folks, and I know it can scare them off and all the rest of that, but it only sometimes takes a few to be well trained to become really effective leaders too. I'd rather develop a church of people who are catalysts and small in number than a huge church of folks that hardly knew the Scriptures at all. That's what Hauge himself was wrestling with. So I don't have a lot of answers on that, and others may want to say, where's the best place to begin? Those of you who are in ministry, in congregations, or who are active as lay people might have a better idea than I do. Marie?
So I'm curious.
Yeah.
My definition, connotation, if you will, experience of pietism here was a very somber, serious, and it might be shame. I miss the grace somehow. I'm not the only one of my generation. Having said that, I understand that's what I heard in an interpretation. You have painted a picture of something. You said the discernment was helpful and was beautiful, and that it's a difficult process to interpret Scripture, and that's what you're saying holding is a part of it. How did that shift occur from discerning what is helpful and what is beautiful and ways to help your neighbor isn't a list of rules to a time, in, at least a time in that I experienced, when it was if you smile, you must be sinning. Sort of.
I know. No good thing. No good thing happens without some serious corruption, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's actually from Luther or even from the Reformation, but that, you know, Ecclesia Reformanda Semper Reformata Semper Reformanda, the church always, Reformed church always reforming. This was our pietism in some ways the second reformation of our church, and it never really got recognized as such in many ways, but it itself needed another stage of that kind of reformation that perhaps didn't happen, perhaps because it wasn't adequately, you know, identified as being in need of that. But those tendencies to be more interested in ourselves than our neighbor, to be self-righteous, to accumulate power in the hands of a few, to want to justify myself at the expense of my neighbor. All those things are traits of human sin that are going to affect every single religious enterprise that ever happens. And so being on guard about that and helping to go back to the heart of God and to the scriptures, that's just an ongoing process, right? And it's really, there needs to be confession in our church around those places where we've hurt people. I heard the stories here, many, many of those, where there were pain done by one to another. And, you know, that's not something I'm going to lay on pietism, whatever that exactly is, or in Haugi necessarily, but to recognize that it needs to be dealt with and healed. And so I don't mean to in any way belittle the hurts that were done by people who claim that heritage. It's just to say that at the heart of it has been some deep and valuable gifts to the church that by simply dismissing it en masse, we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater sort of thing, right? So.
And I hear that, and I thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Getting some balance about all this. Okay. And it's evolving over time.
Mm-hmm. I think one of our future talks in the series will try to address some of that, at least, what happened to pietism, you know, in the North American context.
Good. Good, yeah.
Well, I want to say thank you. It was very refreshing, and especially to hear of Scandinavia pietism, because I'm more acquainted with German pietism. And I want to raise some negative critiques and ask you how much you feel that belong to Scandinavian pietism. The first is, let me quote Werner Ehlers. "It is a sure sign of the invasion of Lutheranism by a strange spirit when pietism begins to subject laughter to censorship." And now he quotes Heinrich Müller, a German pietist pastor in Rostock. "It is better to weep with Jesus than to laugh with the world. One will not find Christ when one laughs. Where do you read that he laughed? But he is very kindly disposed to tears." Now, this is German pietism. I was pleased to hear everybody laugh. But the question, my serious question to you is, do you sense any inability to laugh in Haugi?
Oh yeah. Well, early on, he'd grown up with some of the German pietists, you know, in the home. Those were part of the background of his growing up. And as I say, initially, he had that attitude. I guess as he got out among the people, and particularly after that experience in the field was an experience of such grace and joy that his parents criticized him enormously in the days following, you know, for just being unable to sort of contain it. Pentecostals would call it a baptism in the Spirit, or it was a kind of this just sense of the love and grace of God freeing him from the burden of so much of that anxiety he carried about his sin and about his fear of death and so on. So in some ways, what was the beginning of his work was exactly the opposite. It was a discovery of joy, right? But nonetheless, there was that influence already present in the, you know, in the spiritual kind of. I mean, there were places where that had deeply sunk into the people of Scandinavia, and having to live through these long winters, man, I guess I could
well,
sort of.
Perhaps he read some of Luther on saying that God surely laughs when he sees how happy newly married couples are. And then all those who are happy and do not have the sour look they have, they call fools and sinners.
Yeah.
And that's German pietism.
Yeah.
Now, in Spener and Frank, founders of German pietism that led to Scandinavian pietism, Spener and Frankie were kicked out of their parishes, both of them, in their early ministries, because of conventicalism.
Yeah.
And they, that developed into ecclesiae in ecclesia. Mm-hmm. These people that went into these Bibles, these limited, strictured Bible study groups were the only authentic Christians. Mm-hmm. And they panned anybody who wouldn't join. Their pietism in Germany developed a sense of superiority over everyone else who doesn't follow our line and our way of thinking, laughing, and doing.
Yeah.
And it was a very great problem, this conventicalism in German pietism. And it caused so much rupture in the church that both Spener and Frank here kicked out their parishes because of this conventical approach. Haughey, you alluded to that. There was some problem with this in Haughey's development. There was.
Yeah, yeah.
My third question is, what was Haughey's attitude toward the confessionals? Because there was in the eastern U.S. once a Frankian synod, named after the son of August Hermann Franke, the founder of Pietism. And that synod denied the validity of the Augsburg Confession. And they joined the General Synod.
Yeah.
And then the General Council, the General Council, the much conservative group of the predecessor LCA, had trouble with the General Synod because of Frankian Synod people in there, and those were Pietists. The Eielson Synod later developed into Haughian Evangelical Lutheran Synod, and the Eielson Synod also had a question with the Augsburg Confession. So, can you tell me, what was Haughey's disposition toward Lutheran confessions, apart from, I know he's the scholasticism that developed out of the confessionalism, he opposed.
Yeah.
It's what you do more than what you believe in facts and so on.
Yeah.
But what was his attitude to those confessions?
I know. He does quote occasionally from what I've read and makes references, but there's no, I don't recall, and others may have done, you know, more work on this than I have, but I don't recall any specific sort of position that he takes. In other words, he just assumes it as a kind of a background authority and then makes some use of it occasionally. So he was much more biblically focused than confessionally, certainly, that's for sure. And a number of references to Luther and so forth, but not... I don't recall taking a specific stand theologically, certainly against them. So, and anybody else know more about that than I do?
Back to it.
Okay.
Martin.
David. Yeah.
Well, I just wondering, what was his own educational background? Was he self-taught in the scriptures, or did he have any kind of theological
training? It was basically at home. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really available even to the peasants. So yeah, his parents were.
He was from the peasant class himself.
Yeah, so he was born on a farm and grew up on a farm and just about died a couple of times on the farm and drowning in the rivers, and it was only as he got older, he tried his hand at a variety of things, and that's how he kind of developed some of these entrepreneurial skills. But he had basically been taught by his family. It was kind of like homeschooling, I guess you'd say, for the most part. I mean, there's not a lot about this. There was a small amount, I think, of education that was available in the larger towns nearby, and he may have accessed some of that, but it was mostly self-taught, you know.
I find it strange how the Spirit of God works. We have so many educated people who know the Bible in all different versions and don't see the needs of the poor. Mm. And here we have someone that's home educated and does something about it, and the church puts him in prison.
That's maybe why it's
going.
Well, that's, you know, the tendency, religion and governance are both powerful things, and people that like power are going to gravitate towards those things. There will always be profound and horrendous and even demonic distortions of governmental forms and religious forms as a result. And we ought not to say we won't have any form of governance or any form of religion as a result. We say we've got to find our way back to the heart constantly and keep reminding ourselves of what Christ was all about, right? So I'm not surprised about it. My first council meeting as an intern pastor, someone said, superintendent of Sunday school said, could we have the kids up at the front in the sanctuary this time for the, because they'd always had it downstairs, the Sunday school Christmas concert, and there's just not enough room down there, and the people can't see very well. Could we have it at the front of the church? Well, somebody got up and said, my God, are we going to allow something like this to happen in our church, where we will have children up behind the fence, whatever, the rail, and possibly standing in the pulpit, and who knows doing what, picking their nose or whatever? And we said, we have never allowed that from the day this congregation was established, and this is the first step down the road to.
That sounds like German fighting.
Well, it was a German church, actually, but not a joyless one, because when I went out for the confirmation things, there was the free flow of alcohol, so we had a good time. But nonetheless, there was that one, at least, that person had some control issues, right? He'd been in control of this for a long time and was deeply upset that. And I went home thinking to myself, I'm going to have to give up on the ministry. I honestly could not possibly serve in a place where that kind of attitude persists. And as I've grown older, I just realized, of course, sin infects and will always threaten to undo the work of the Spirit, and we just have to be constantly at work helping to nurture and raise it up in every place we can find and resist those things. So anyway, I'm dying to get to the left, so I'm sure there's some out there. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much.